The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition today. On today's show, we're going to do things a little bit different. We've done this in the past, and it's not super different, but we're going to have a tax-focused EDU show. So it is going to be question and answer-based in that we have a few email questions, but because it's an email or a tax-focused show, even though it's going to behave kind of like a Q&A show, anytime we focus on taxes, we bring Bob on. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Chris.
Jim's not here, so no Jim-isms today, but Bob and I are going to roll through some interesting tax-related questions that have to do with retirement and things surrounding retirement, and so we'll just call this a tax-related EDU show. And how you been doing, by the way?
Nice to see you. Yeah, I've been doing good. It's kind of nice to be outside a little bit more, and things are kind of opening up a little bit.
Yeah, things are slightly more normal now. Yeah. And we're, as you can tell, we're both in the recording studio, but we have an enormous table, so we're still socially distancing, even though we're both in the studio. So, so let's go to this first one. This first question we had in has multiple facets to it, I'd say. So let's tackle this more complicated one first, I think, is the best way to go.
Sounds good.
And I'm going to skip over, I'm going to skip through this. This is a very long email, but we kind of parsed through it to get to the heart of the matter. And there's really two elements to this. But it starts off with, Dear Jim and Chris, thanks, and Bob, I'm sure she meant to say, thank you for all the wonderful information on the show. She goes on about being a longtime listener. And she ultimately says, I have a question regarding IRMA and submitting a life-changing event form. So first, for those who are not aware, IRMA, that stands for Income-Related Monthly Adjustment Amount. In other words, it's the Medicare premium surcharges that are income-related. There's different tiers, whether you're filing single, married filing separately, or married filing jointly. But in essence, if you have more modified adjusted gross income than is allowed under these tiers, or I guess it's allowed, but you enter into a zone of having higher Medicare premiums, the income related, that's the reference to, it's based on your level of income being reported on your tax return. Monthly adjustment amount means it's the monthly Medicare premiums are adjusted, and they don't adjust them down, they adjust them upwards. Just for some context here, married filing jointly, that first tier is at $174,000. So it's rather high, but there's a lot of ways you can have income for a couple over $174,000. But if you do, the premium surcharge on your Part B premium, you'd pay the regular amount, which in 2020 is $144.60 is the Medicare Part B premium for most people. And you'd pay an extra $57.80. So the first tier isn't super painful, but that's where they start, and they continue upward all the way to the point where the upper tier is $347 in addition to the $145 basic premium. So you can see if you have big enough AGI, you're going to really pay a lot more than the average person pays for Medicare Part B. So that gives some context to this particular situation. That's what IRMA is. But there are some, we call them get out of jail free cards. There's a half a dozen or so life-changing events that Medicare system recognizes. It's technically Social Security. For those of you who don't know, the Social Security Administration administers the Medicare program, so that's why most of these forms are SSA forms. They give us six life-changing events. Is it six? Actually, no, it's eight. Sorry, I knew it was an even number. Eight life-changing events that qualify for an exception to the IRMA rules, so you can get out of having to pay those premium surcharges, even though your modified adjusted gross income might imply that you should pay those premiums. So a lot of setup there. Now let me get into her particular question, her IRMA story. She recently heard our program about appealing IRMA. Having spent several months attempting to process, I thought I would share my experience. Briefly, I'm 71 years old, retired recently after working since 1969. My income for 2018 and 2019, we're recording this in 2020, was approximately $98,000 per year. My annual income will be around $4,500 based on Social Security and my only other source of income, my 401k. So she'll, ongoing, she'll have some income, but her job has stopped. But right before she retired, she made almost $100,000 a year. I'm legally separated as of a long time ago. For religious reasons, they're separated rather than divorced. So they're legally separated. After retiring, I applied for Medicare Part B, which originally they told me it would cost $144.60, but I got a second letter that said I would be charged $462.70 because of IRMA, because our filing status was married filing separately with income over $87,000. So remember that I told you that a married filing joint couple had to be have an AGI over $174,000 to get that first tier. Here, married filing separately, that tier is what they mentioned in the letter, the $87,000. And Bob, what's the real zinger then if you're over $87,000 married filing separately?
Well, you jump right to the second highest tier.
Right. You bypass the little tier, right?
The first couple little tiers. Yeah,
the first three don't exist. And you jump all the way to the $318 adjustment.
Yes. Then that's the 80% tier. So essentially, right, they're taking you from paying 25% of your share, well, the share of Medicare Part B cost, estimated at 25%, and they take that to you're now paying 80% of that cost.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know, that's how they determine the Medicare Part B premiums. They figure out what the premium should be based on the costs of the Medicare system and all this sort of stuff. They figure out what your portion should be, and then they only make you pay, as long as you're not penalized like this. Is it 25 or 20? Is it 25?
25.
Is the starting? So 25% of that amount. So that's what they do. They start with this large number, and then they say your portion, it's kind of like being at an employer where the employer is going to pick up 75% and you pick up 25%. That's essentially how Medicare Part B works.
Exactly.
And every year to the employer, as the premiums for this go up, they keep paying their 75% and you pay your 25. But IRMA undoes that relationship and essentially says, no, the premium to you is the same, or the premium attributed to you is the same. You're just going to be on the hook for more than your 25%. And it goes all the way up to 80%. Is that the top bracket, or isn't the top bracket all of it?
The top bracket is 85%. That was added in 2019.
Right. So of that total premium, if you're in the highest AGI bracket for IRMA, you're going to pay 85% of the total premium attributed to you, and the Medicare system's only picking up 15. So I guess they're throwing in a little bit, even for, quote, rich people. But anyway, and, you know, I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's a very small portion for those folks. Well, the zinger with married filing separately is that, if she were filing single, what would she have to pay in a penalty if she had in that first tier, which she is? The $100,000 would fall into the first tier for a single person. What's the penalty?
Her total cost would go to $202.40 a month. So that's about $58 increase.
Yeah. So that would be the penalty if she were filing singly. if they attributed her that 98,000. Now, you might be saying, wait a minute, this is 2020, and she made this money back in 2018 and 2019. Well, again, since we're talking about Irma, we have to remind people that they take your AGI from two calendar years before to determine your Irma for the current year. They determine your Irma at the beginning of every year in January. Obviously, in January, the most recent tax return that they have accessible to them is the one that you filed the previous year. So in January 2020, they'd look at her most recent tax filing, which she would have done in the spring of 2019, right? But the spring of 2019 tax return is for
2018
calendar year, or tax year, technically. So the most recent tax return they have to base this on is from 2 years prior. The 2018 activity determines the 2020 Irma. And so they're looking at that $98,000 and saying, well, you're above the $87,000 for married filing separately, so you owe a penalty or an adjustment, they call it, of an extra $318. So your premium is what we quoted, that $462 and some change. And that was shocking to her. But then she went on and said, there was a note on the form. It said, if you lived apart throughout the year, see below. And the note below said, quote, if you lived apart from your spouse at all times during 2018, we may be able to lower your income-related premium amount. And then, based on that statement, she tried to pursue this to figure out, how can I reduce this? That seems to have an exception, and they say, and this applied to her, that she's been separated for a very, very long time, legally separated. They don't live together. They were apart the entire year. So this statement, this footnote, applied directly to her. So she contacted, and unfortunately, she got all kinds of convoluted information. She got a lot of, this is correct. It's all about your income. That note doesn't really mean anything. And that's all wrong, actually. So the first thing is, if you are married filing separately and you lived apart the entire year, if you lived apart only part of the year, that you were together and then you were apart, this doesn't apply. You're going to be stuck in this really in penalty phase, I guess. If you lived apart the entire year and you're willing to sign a document with Social Security, aka Medicare, swearing this to be true by your signature under penalty of perjury, they will change the formula. They will change how they address this and may very well reduce or eliminate the Irma. So, little known fact, this exception does exist, but it doesn't have anything to do with an appeal. So this is actually a two-phased question. We're going to deal with an appeal issue here. But the note does have validity. The note at the bottom that states, if you are filing married filing separately and lived apart the entire year, all 365 days, and you swear to this, they will give you relief under the Irma provisions. Maybe even eliminating it altogether. It depends on your situation. It depends on your income levels between you and the other person that's filing married, filing separately with you, that also lived apart from you all year long. So I can't tell you exactly how much it'll be reduced, because actually they don't publish for public consumption a nice clean table that explains this. All I know is, and I know people that have been in this circumstance, and I know that has benefited them. So I know for a fact that this provision does exist, despite the bad information that she was getting from at least Social Security and maybe even from the IRS, because later in her statement, she talks about getting information from the IRS. Now, ultimately, Social Security administers all this, and this has to do with Social Security. She may have called the IRS about her filing status or something like that, but anyway, I feel sorry that she's getting bad information on this, but we have some good news, don't we, Bob?
We do. There's a couple ways that she can kind of fix this. You know, the first one is the one that you were just talking about calling the SSA and getting a different person, or you know, just revisiting the whole married Fong yeah. separate living
this is where
apart.
This is where you'd yeah. approach a technical expert at the ask for a technical expert in the office. Mm-hmm. And or at least nicely ask them to research it and get back to you, because they will find mm-hmm. that there is some validity to this. But in mm-hmm. in her case, since somebody who's sharp listening to my description might have picked up on this, she may not need to pursue this at all.
That's correct. She has, well, she just retired. And so that's one of the eight, I guess they're called like exemptions, mm-hmm. or basically it's a life-changing event.
Right, so there's these eight life-changing events. Just to remind people, Bob, what are those eight life-changing events?
Let's see. We have marriage, divorce, mm-hmm. so going into a marriage, ending a marriage, mm-hmm. death of a spouse, mm-hmm. work stoppage, which is generally retirement, or you mm-hmm. lose your job, you're laid off. Mm-hmm. You know, those are indications. These are all indications of probably a drop in MAGI,
right.
the modified adjusted gross income. And so, and that's what would be your reason for pursuing this, is if I'm not making that kind of money any longer, right. So I shouldn't have to pay this extra fee. Work reduction, your hours are cut back, mm-hmm. full-time to part-time. Again, lower income. Loss of income-producing property. That, and we kind of talked about this.
Yeah, that was one that somebody asked us about, I think, because they thought, well, I sold my rental property. I don't have that rental income anymore. That should be a get-out-of-jail-free card. Mm-hmm. No. Loss of income-producing property isn't the loss due to you choosing to sell it. It is loss because it was destroyed by a hurricane or something like that. You lost it like it was a property loss or casualty.
Kind
of event. It's not a, if it was by your choice... Yeah. Doesn't count.
That's right. That's one of the distinguishing characteristics, is was it by your choice? Was it in a disaster area or a flood zone, or did you decide to sell it?
Right.
And that doesn't count. The last two are loss of pension income and employer settlement payment.
So that one is if the income that's causing your AGI to be so high to cause this. Mm-hmm. But it was a one-time employment settlement, like an early retirement offer or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Also get out of jail free card on the IRMA. Those eight things. And of that eight, if you noticed, she qualifies for one of them. Work stoppage. Mm-hmm. She said that her income is going to be quite low now that she's on Social Security and she's not working anymore. Essentially, she just has to file this SSA 44. That's the form.
Mm-hmm.
And provide documentation that she did, in fact, retire, that she stopped work. They ask for documentation for it. You send it in with it. You can either go to the office and deliver the form with the proof, or you can mail it all in. That's the easiest. But they do ask for proof that you retired. So any kind of documentation indicating that will suffice from your employer. And they will then say, okay, instead of using your 2018, because your circumstances have changed due to this life-changing event, what is your income going to be this year? And that's what we'll use to determine your IRMA. And she'll say, my $4,500 a year of Social Security and then a little bit of 401k distributions I'm going to take to live on. Should be well under the limits, even if they're misapplying the married filing separate but living apart all year provision. I think she should keep that in the back pocket in case they come back on her in the future and try to apply that, because like I just mentioned, it does exist and she should get relief there. But instead of trying to convince what appears to be several people at Social Security and or the IRS that she should get this special treatment because she lived apart the entire year, much easier is to just claim life-changing event. She actually has one definite get out of jail free card, the life-changing event, mm-hmm. and then one that may reduce it completely or at least reduce it some, but not apply this really onerous penalty that is the table of married filing separate as it applies to IRMA. So that would be my recommendation, is filing that SSA 44. She already is familiar with it because in the rest of her letter she talked about having it, but on there, the married filing separately but living apart all year, someone directed her to this form to file an appeal. Well, that isn't one of the eight. This form is specifically for just those eight, and it has to be one of those eight for this form, this appeal, to work. She has one. She was just trying to put the wrong thing on the form.
Right.
She needs to use life-changing event work stoppage rather than going down this rabbit hole, possibly convincing people that she needs an exception because they lived apart, married, filing separate, which is of these life-changing events are very common. Those are easy to process. Everyone at Social Security will know about those. This other one she was pursuing is a one-off strange event that applies to a very, very small group of people. And everyone she's talked to just didn't know the ins and outs of it. Anyway, was there, I think that pretty much tackled everything in that email. Was there anything else that,
I think that was it. You know, she did inquire a little bit about her filing status. I guess we could touch briefly on that. Mm-hmm. When the IRS, when you want to file single status, the IRS basically, you know, looks at two things. One is, are you unmarried? And two is, they'll defer to the state. And in states, if you're a resident of a state that allows a legal separation agreement to exist, and it's through the courts, so it's an official decree of separation, you're basically separated from your spouse financially. You're not living together. You're not liable for each other's bills. It's everything but a divorce. The only thing you really can't do at that point is get remarried, because technically you're still married. Mm-hmm. If you have that agreement, if you're in a state that recognizes those agreements and you have that agreement, the IRS will then consider you to be single as a tax filing status. Mm-hmm. And that's usually a favorable status anyway compared to marrying filing separately. And this also would have alleviated this from the beginning. It might have alleviated some of this.
Would have made it better, but she still was above that first tier for – it would have lessened the burden – but with our life-changing event approach, it should eliminate the extra surcharge completely. But you're right. If she had convinced everyone that she can file singly and did file singly, they would have applied the single filer IRMA table, which at $87,000 to 100 and something, so her $98,000 salary would have fallen into that category. The penalty was only like $58 instead of the $318. But I think she can get out. I'm convinced she can get out of the whole thing with the life-changing event issue. Mm-hmm. But certainly for IRMA purposes, let's say you were married filing separate but did live together for a month or so. But during that same year, you got the legal separation as well. So you wouldn't get that this weird footnote exception issue because you did live together for a little bit. So they're not going to grant you relief there. But you could possibly at least get the single, you know, married, be able to file married filing single to avoid the IRMA surcharge that might apply in your case. So at least lessen it. So
right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
There's a not a real common thing, but unfortunately, it's fairly common when you have a one-off circumstance to get a number of people at the Social Security Administration that don't quite have the whole story correct as far as the rules go. So it is worth asking a technical expert at Social Security. This isn't a third party. This is someone at Social Security that has a ton of experience and probably has run across occasionally these one-off rare events and will also know to go to the Program Operations Manual, the POMS, which is the Bible for how everything works at Social Security. And I checked the POMS today before the show just to make sure that this still existed, about living separately the whole year and having to treat it as a special exception. And it's still in there. It's still in there. Hasn't been removed. So anyway, I think we've, in Jim's, I said there's no Jimisms, but we've now beat that horse to death. So I'll throw a Jimism out there.
Is that a Jimism?
That's a Jimism. Yeah.
Okay.
Which he swears as other people that say that. I think it's the futility of beating a horse that's already dead that's supposed to be. So it's beating a dead horse. But anyway, so there we go. So you've got the next question, not quite as convoluted and multifaceted, but interesting nonetheless.
It's a little, yeah, a little shorter. I'm going to read most of it. It's a follow-up because it's another Irma question. This one is a little bit more specific to the time periods. So this listener's not sure when they're, well, they know when they're turning 65. They know when they're going to apply for Medicare. They're just not sure what years the Social Security Administration is going to look at and when those changes are going to occur. And so she starts out and says, "Hi, Jim and Chris."
And Bob, she meant.
Well, you know what? This one is from December. Oh, okay. We're a little late getting to this one. So this is a little before Bob. So my question, she says, is about the timing of MAGE limits and IRMA. I turned 65 in October 2021, so a year and a little bit from now. And my husband turned 65 in November of 2021, so the following month. She says, from what I've read, the calculation for my Medicare premium will be based on the MAGI of my most recent tax forms on file, which I assume will be the forms I submit by April 2021 for the tax year 2020. So I think to start with, I think she's off 1 year.
Yeah, it would make, I see her thinking that they've, if you filed in January, they wouldn't have gotten your form yet for the immediately previous tax year, but after April, it should be in there and they should be able to use it. Technically, that's true, but like many things, they set the Medicare premiums once a year for you, January. That's just how it works. So even though you aren't going onto Medicare until October or November, they've determined what you're going to pay January. And in January, they don't have yet your, now we're looking a year ahead, so in January of 2021, when they're going to turn 65, they do not yet have their 2020 tax return.
Correct.
They have the most recent one, 2019. So again, there's this two-year separation. The income or AGI from 2019 is going to determine their premiums for 2021, which for them is only going to affect them for a couple of months, right? Because they're claiming it or going on Medicare towards the end of the year. But nonetheless, the fact that they've in between filed a 2020 tax return, they don't look at it that way. It's like the computer only works in December. And they run all these calculations in December, and so they can apply the changes for everyone across the whole country that's in Medicare in January. And then the guy who does that calculation is then on break, on vacation, for the next 10 months until it's time to do the calculation for the next year. That's obviously not how it works, but that's effectively kind of what's we see from the outside that's going on.
Yeah, it's probably that, or maybe they're allowed one data dump a year, you know.
It's just there's a lot of things. They have to deal with a lot of people and a lot of data and getting it all set up. They just get it all set up, do all the work, and do one massive run, and then it's in there for the year.
Right. And it's kind of funny. I mean, they could have access to that information sooner. I mean, we saw the stimulus checks go out, and within a few weeks, they knew everybody's AGI, even from tax returns that were just being filed. That was strictly the IRS. So we're going to say there's a different agency involved and a little lag sharing the information. But that is correct. So for them, when they apply, I think it's a 7 month window, right? Starts 3 months before your birthday. So if you're early and you're right at the beginning of the 3 month period, you notify that you want to collect on Medicare, you're going to get a letter. And for them, their IRMA, if they're subject to IRMA, it's going to be based off their 2019 income, and it's only going to apply to them for either 2 or 3 months. And then in January, they're going to get a new letter saying what their new rate's going to be, IRMA, not IRMA, different tier, based on, so for them, this will be January of 2022. So now they'll be looking at the 2020 tax year. And that will be a readjusted, and then they'll live with that for all of 2022, and then 2023 adjusts again. Always the 2-year rule, unless you have life-changing event, right, like we just talked about.
Yeah, so you can get relief from this with those life-changing events. Mm-hmm. But if you, a classic example is somebody in 1 year sells some property and realizes a large gain. It's not a life-changing event. Some people, again, if it was a rental property, they say, oh, no, it was loss of rental income or loss of income-producing property. No, it's not, not unless it got destroyed in a hurricane or something like that. You selling it is not it. So there's that, and you have this big spike in recognized income, right, in AGI from the gain on that property sale. And you might think, well, it's just, you know, it was in a particular part of the year, but it doesn't matter. It's going to penalize you for the whole year, 2 years later, 2 years later. So this is actually a case where I've seen people transact something or sell a property when they were 62 instead of 63, because if they sold it when they were 63, they're going to get IRMID for their first year of Medicare at 65, and it was enough of a penalty that it was worth it for them to change their plans and just accelerate the transaction a little bit. But these are things. The good news is they look at it every year. So if you do have one of these one-time events, not a life-changing event, because those will, you know, get you off the hook, but if it's a one-time event that spikes your AGI, you're only going to pay this Medicare. It's not like it permanently pushes you into this upper tier. They'll drop you back down, maybe into the base tier, the next year after they see your next tax return and that spike isn't on there anymore.
That's correct. Yeah, it's a one-year hit. And IRMA planning really does begin at age 63. If you're in those levels, you're concerned about this, the year you turn 63 is the year to really plan for it. You know, if you can reduce your AGI that year below these thresholds, good planning opportunity, you know, contribute some more to your 401k, contribute to your HSA, anything you can do to get that down. Keep in mind, when you go over these limits by a dollar, you're in that limit. You're in that tier.
They're cliffs. Yep.
So, and you know, we had somebody here earlier this year, we were looking at them and they were, I think it was a couple hundred dollars. They just a few hundred dollars got them into the first tier. So very close call. And in that, you know, if you're looking at a few hundred dollars or a couple thousand dollars, planning for that is a little easier to figure out ways of getting that down the year you turn 63, so that when you turn 65, you're either in a lower tier or out of it altogether.
Yeah. And those people doing Roth conversions, remember, Roth conversions create recognized income on your income tax return. And if you get too aggressive on those, you're going to push yourself up above those IRMA limits and cause yourself to pay these. So there's not just an income tax question on a Roth conversion, but also IRMA questions if you're 63 or above. And even, you know, there's even an overlap between 63 and 65. You might also be dealing with pursuing ACA premium tax credits in those years. So you could cause yourself a double whammy. You do a big Roth conversion as age 63, you're going to maybe lose the AC premium tax credits and create a year's worth of IRMA for yourself 2 years later as a special surprise that honk sneaks up on you that you didn't realize. So
yeah,
you got to think about these things.
You know, you're exactly right, Chris. And, you know, the software we use, it does plan for those. It factors in both of those items and says, you know, maybe that Roth conversion should be a little lower, or maybe we should delay it a year. To avoid other taxes besides, well, I'm going to, you know, I'm in the 22% bracket. I'm going to pay 22% tax on a Roth conversion. Well, there's a couple hidden things in there that could make that a lot higher than 22%.
Right. Perfect. Okay.
So I'm going to finish out her question. She says, let's see where we were at. So the married and filing jointly limit for 2020 before being subject to IRMA is $218,000. And I think what she did there was that's the upper limit of the first tier. So I just think she might have looked at what she was looking at.
The wrong side of the tier.
Yes. Yeah. You know, it starts at $174 in a dollar and it ends at $218.
Right.
So the $218 is the upper limit of the first tier. So if you really want to stay below IRMA for married filing jointly, you want to stay under the $174 0001. She says, I do not yet know what the 2021 limit is going to be. And I don't think I've seen those numbers come out yet either.
No, and it may not go up even if there's inflation. Those are intended and allowed to increase for inflation. But as those who track these types of things know, from the creation of the IRMA rules, they actually froze them at those levels for a long period of time. And just recently actually inflated them for the first time because they were allowed to do it under the legislation to kind of capture more and more people into these IRMA limits because they initially didn't capture as many as they'd hoped. So they left the levels, these tiers, where they were for I forget how many years, but it was a number of years. And with the idea that as people's AGIs, as their income grew, that more and more would get ensnared in the net. And they decided, okay, we've gotten enough now. We're going to inch it up a little bit. And they inflated a little bit. But you can't plan on those increasing every year. They don't necessarily increase every year. And to my knowledge, they have not yet reached the target percentage of the population that they were hoping to capture into IRMA. So my guess is these IRMA limits are going to be pretty stuck in molasses. Might move a little, mm-hmm. but they're going to be stuck quite a bit for a while. And as inflation occurs and the corresponding AGI increases that result from that over time, more and more people are going to get stuck in here. But the 174 is the limit or ceiling to remain completely unaffected by IRMA. You go over that. If you're talking about the number she's talking about, you'd be fully through the first tier, which isn't super onerous, but she's teasing with the second tier, which gets larger, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she kind of goes on and kind of finishes up a little bit, and we sort of answered this already, but she's kind of asking about with the birthday late in the year, will her first IRMA surcharge at the end of 2021, will that carry through 2022? And no, it will get reset right. Again in January of 2022 based on the 2020.
Now, does she indicate any of that income? Does she have a life-changing event where she can maybe avoid all of this? Is this from employment income that she no longer has, or did she indicate?
She does not indicate if they're working and about to retire this year or next year or...
Okay.
Yeah, there's not enough information there to know if she would qualify for a life-changing event.
Okay. Something to look into. If we don't know one way or the other because she didn't give that detail to us, but that's certainly always something to look at.
Right.
Because then she wouldn't have to worry about it. So.
Exactly.
Okay. So you have one more?
We have one more question, and a little bit off. Well, it's a little off the IRMA topic, but nevertheless, it's a good question. Well, I had it sitting here right in front of me.
Oh, you're doing your Jim imitation. That's his classic case. Is he'd have his pile all ready to go, and then we get to it, and then he can't find it because he put it in another pile. So,
I did find it. I was going to blame you because you were.
We can always pause the recording. Yeah.
No, I'm just going to blame you because you were bringing papers over to me, and I think my system got a little. The only problem is it was at the very bottom. So,
no problem.
But I did find it. So then we got another listener that wrote in. He did a Roth IRA conversion in April of this year. So he has already done a Roth conversion for $120,000, probably timed that one pretty well, depending on what part of April. He's trying to determine if I need to send in quarterly estimated tax payments. So the overall question is, what happens if I underpay my taxes this year? So the tax return he files next April 2021 for 2020, he's going to owe additional taxes on this Roth conversion. We don't know his income or his bracket, but for argument's sake, it's probably going to be a $20,000 to $30,000 tax bill to do this conversion. So I am a W-2 employee, so I get biweekly taxes withheld from my paycheck. So that's good. He's got some withholdings coming out currently. and that's important. So what we want to look at is if there's three ways of the safe harbor plan. The safe harbor allows.
So before you go to protect it, what are they? They'll be penalized with an under withholding penalty.
Like under withholding, underpayment.
Underpayment penalty.
Right.
If you don't withhold enough, the IRS will say, well, you should have been sending us in this money. You didn't. You kept it instead, and we're going to penalize you a little bit because we'd rather have it, and you weren't following our rules on withholding and sending it into us throughout the year. That's what the penalty he's worried about. Bob's now going to share how you can avoid that penalty.
Right, exactly. So, they like you said, Chris, IRS wants their money during the year. They'd much rather send you a check next year if your balance due is over $1,000. So that's one of the safe harbors. If you owe less than $1,000, there's no underpayment penalty.
He's not going to get a why on that one.
He's not going to
do that kind of conversion.
He's not going to get there. The other one he's probably not going to meet is always if you pay in at least 90% of your current tax bill.
So that essentially is if you did withhold and you just got it a little bit wrong, they say, you got close enough. If you at least withheld 90% of your tax burden, yeah, you were a little short, but you're close enough, so we're not going to penalize you. That's essentially the rule.
Exactly. So, you know, if you owe $20,000 is your liability for the year and you've paid in at least $18,000, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
The $2,000 you send in, no penalty, no interest.
See, I wish I could penalize them for over withholding. Say, I gave you all this extra money. You should cut me out. You should give me a little interest or something. But nope.
Doesn't work that way. Yeah. Doesn't work that way, unfortunately. And he's probably not going to be eligible for that either. We don't have all of his numbers, but the odds are that additional Roth conversion, the taxes due on that additional Roth conversion are probably going to keep him under the 90% current year. So he's probably not going to have that safe harbor to rely on either. So the one that he can rely on the best is paying in a percentage of your prior year tax liability. So prior year being 2019, if his tax liability on his 1040 is X number of dollars, this year, if his withholdings from his payroll is that number or higher, he's protected.
Oh, even though he might have underwithheld a lot because that bit, maybe he did the big Roth conversion and has a bunch higher tax penalty or tax owed. It's not a penalty, but I guess it could be in some people's eyes, but the tax owed. Mm. As long as he withheld 100% or more of what he owed last year, not what he withheld last year, but what he owed last year, they also say, oh, okay, at least you did your best. You, based on what you knew about your most recent tax experience, you withheld that amount or more, and we'll say you at least gave it a good try, and we'll let you off the hook. But you, even if you had this one-time, one-off event that caused, in this case, even it was his choice doing a Roth conversion, we'll let you off the hook this one time. That only works once, though. Next year, of course, this one won't work unless he withholds 100% of the previous year, which then includes that Roth conversion. Mm-hmm. So you might be thinking, oh, I'll just do that every year. No, it's a rolling situation. So you can't have that massive under withholding and still get out under one of these safe harbor rules only gets you off the hook that one time. It's not an ongoing rule because that ratchets back up the following year. So,
right.
But if you make a one-time mistake and did something you didn't anticipate and you didn't realize that you should be sending in withholding from these big conversions. But if you do these yearly, then they're not going to give you grace in the following years. You're going to need to have done what you should do or what they want you to do, which is estimate your taxes and get them withheld or send in estimated tax payments.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. So he can, and just one other note on that, on the prior year rule, the 100% of the prior year's taxes, if your AGI in that prior year is above 150, okay, it's 110% ratio. So they have an extra little gotcha. So yeah, they want a little bit more. They're partnering with everybody, And so if your AGI, or in this case, if his AGI last year was above 150, then he would have to, let's use example of the $20,000 liability, he'd have to pay in $22,000 through withholdings this year.
In order to have safe harbor for other taxes above that that he was generated, in this case, because of the Roth conversion. So
right.
that's a little bit weird. That's annoying, actually. Like someone making 150 just would automatically withhold 110% the next year. That just seems weird. I find it reasonable that you do your taxes, you figure out what you owed, and you're like, oh, I was wrong this year, so let me set up my withholding so that I cover what I've now figured out is what my true tax burden is likely to be. To have someone arbitrarily, if you just happen to be over 150, have to say, oh, and let me add 10% just for fun. I don't know. That one bothers me a little bit.
Yeah, that's their fun rule, just for fun, a little bit extra. That's been around for a while, so I don't know if it's going to go away. So that would be, so in this case, like how I would kind of plan, if I was this guy is, I look at my last paycheck, my last pay stub, and look at my withholdings to date, and look at how much, if I'm on a salary or I'm a fairly, my pay is fairly regular every week or every biweekly, and just look at how many more paychecks you're going to get for the year, times what you're having withheld every week, and do the math and say, okay, I'm going to end the year with this dollar amount of withholdings. Is it more than last year's tax liability or more than 110% of last year's tax liability if I'm in that group? And if it is, I'm good to go. I can set aside some money. I can pay my taxes next year, no underpayment penalty, no interest. If it's short, if it's going to come up short for some reason, talk to HR, go in there, or if you have the online, a lot of programs are online, you can change that yourself now and increase that withholding so that the rest of the year, you can cover that. You could always send in some money, but this just kind of keeps you from having to do a quarterly estimate, a separate payment.
Yeah, and that's why we're recommending that. Here he has income coming in that is subject to withholding, or at least he's having withholding taken out and sent in. It's very easy to change that number without any filing extra stuff. Well, you might have to file something with your HR department, but it's very simple to do. Going through the calculations and filling out the forms to do a one-off mailing in a check for a quarterly estimated tax payment is a little more pain in the butt. So that obviously, if he didn't have anything else coming in, and here he has a job, but if he had Social Security or a pension or other types of regular recurring income or maybe regular distributions coming out of a taxable account, he could tell them withhold X amount, and it's easy to change that amount. So we always look at this and say, what's the easiest way to cure this? The easiest way would be to increase the withholdings, like Bob just mentioned. But if you don't have any of that, if it's purely you don't have any of that regular recurring stuff already set up, quarterly estimated tax payments is your fallback. That's what you're going to need to do if you're not going to get protected by one of these safe harbor rules that Bob just mentioned. And those aren't terrible, right? Those aren't terribly painful as far as doing the paperwork and sending it in and everything. Right? Lots of people do it.
Yeah, lots of people do it. You can even go online to the IRS.gov website and set up your own personal account and make an ACH payment that way directly from your checking account.
Right. Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, anything else? We knocked that one out.
We knocked that one out.
Perfect. Yeah.
I asked Jim for a fourth one, and he didn't find one. Well, he didn't find one before we started. So
this is a full enough show. As long as we get past about 40, 45 minutes, it's a full show. We usually go a little longer because the Q&A show always goes long because we have a huge pile of questions. We never have a shortage of those questions. But here we're at almost 50 minutes.
So okay, well, perfect. Yeah.
Sweet spot. So not too short, not too long.
This time just flies by when you're having all this fun, exactly. Right? Talking about all these interesting conversations.
So thanks a lot for coming upstairs and sharing this 50 minutes with me and talking to our podcast listeners. We appreciate all you podcast listeners, and here we dealt with questions specifically on the EDU show. If you have any questions of clarification related to what we just talked about, go to the website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And through the contact form on there, you can send us a message. And if it's something I need to get over to Bob, we can get it to Bob. Or if it's something we need to address more fully on a future Q&A or EDU show, we're happy to do that. Or if you have an idea for one of these EDU shows where this was, again, a little different. Usually an EDU show, we take one topic and go kind of deep into one particular topic. This, we considered tax the topic, even though we had a few different elements going on. Mm-hmm. But this was a quite a bit of Irma, actually, today. But if you have a good idea for an EDU show, certainly send us a question there. And then if you have just a regular old retirement-related question, you can send us a question through that same contact form at jimhelps.com. And we'll deal with that on our Q&A show, which if you're a podcast listener, you're most likely familiar with that as well, where we handle all the variety of questions that come in on all the different aspects of retirement planning. So we really appreciate everybody, and we'll be back with you next week with another new show.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.